models talk core.
It's talk, but it's also core.
Blah, blah, blah.
It seems everyone is talking about talk core.
Would you like more talk core?
It's talk core from new models.
Hey, Reagan, when you come to your office.
Lately, on this podcast, we speak as if the human content layer is so compromised it doesn't even exist in a one-to-one human relation anymore. But that's not actually true. We take that stance sometimes as a provocation to expand the ways that we think about media, to get us thinking outside of content. But all the time, at the same time, this primary layer does still exist. And we, Julian and I, and I'm guessing all of you listening, do personally engage with it a lot, have strong feelings about it. One of our favorite artists working in this register is Stephen Warwick, aka Heatsick. He's a returning guest and longtime friend of New Models. Full disclosure, he literally married us during COVID among 2,000-year-old ruins along the Turkish coast. He's a writer, a critic, an actor, a musician, a playwright, and a consummately interesting, I actually had deviant, but that felt weird, devious mind, all of the above, I think. The last time he came on—
I think it's both. Devious and deviant.
Devious and deviant, exactly. The last time he came on the show was to discuss his long-form essay book, Notes on Evil, which was it 4 years ago now, 2022?
Yeah, 2022.
So crazy. Time, what is it? The first time he came on New Models was actually way back in 2018 when we first started the podcast. He was one of our very first guests.
Third episode, I think.
Third episode.
Psytrance and
synth and bass lines. Which was, I think the aim of that podcast was to talk about the bureaucratization of culture under platform capitalism.
Ah, yeah.
If I remember.
Gender.
Yeah, and specifically it was sort of like the bureaucratization of, how do you say that word?
The bureaucratization,
yeah, of queer culture in particular, and how that changes our daily experience of it. Like in the online space, it was taking on these certain qualities. I just remember Stephen saying Bestätigung.
Yes.
Yeah. And like every time I think of that word, which in German means confirmation, I think of Stephen. But like how there was this need to, whereas the idea of queerness had been about getting outside of the lines, suddenly there was a way where you had to like check boxes. He joins us here to speak about two recent music releases, one on Pan Records, Live at Cafe Otto, that came out in March, and the other on Huntley's and Palmer's, April 22nd. And he's here also to weigh in on the state of the world more generally. So, Stephen Warwick, welcome back to New Models.
Thanks for having me back. Yeah, good to see you both.
It's really nice to have you in the room.
Yeah.
Well, so these two releases, maybe let's start by chatting about these, because I feel like a lot of what we've done on the New Models podcast over the past several months has been really analyzing how we communicate, what happened to the content layer, like really abstracting that, really trying to think outside of that register. But like at the same time, as I said, like stuff is happening on that level. And my question is kind of like, as somebody who's completely aware of the media environment and who's an analyst of how culture flows through it, what is the experience right now of making art on the one-to-one relation, not necessarily at a protocol layer, but like at the human layer?
Yeah, well, I mean, you've seen this rise again of playing live, but also a listening event or a playback, or, you know, the rise of a listening bar. Yeah, I just felt like when you have these listening bar, like these social experiences, people have really latched onto them.
Yeah.
And, you know, like during the lockdown, there was all these promises of shopping in the metaverse or like digital or being online.
Digital, God, that word.
And you're like, well, where did that get us? But on like a kind of subcultural level, there was a lot of moral surveillance in the last 8 to 10 years. That kind of explains the rise of people just wanting to be messy again, or like this Gen Z aesthetic coming back in, or even like brat or whatever. But I think people had this burnout of constantly monitoring themselves, self-surveillance, and just being too self-aware and too cognizant of how they're being perceived. And people just want to have moments where they can listen again and like switch off. And like, it's kind of how we grew up.
Do you think that in part, there's also this decentering of the individual, both as an individual audience member slash user, but also as an artist. I mean, in some way, these albums are both made with others, but Live at Cafe Auto is made at Cafe Auto.
Exactly.
It's like a jazz musician in like the 1950s or 60s going and you can play a jazz standard any number of ways. Every single time you perform it, it's different. But here you are taking like a snapshot of a certain social relation of your album as it's being received in the space. How do you think of what it is to produce an album? Maybe what it means to be part of a social body as opposed to making something in isolation. Like think of the Madonna album in the 90s where everything's super perfectly produced, right? Even like Charlie's Brat is messy in ways.
Like when I released Reengineering, even like a while ago in like 2013 as Heatsick, I had a discussion then about like what's the function of an album, you know, like do people even still listen to albums? They kind of make playlists or they just listen to the odd track, or it's like that was already like a conversation about it being more like algorithmic or whatever. And people making albums now, it is a bit more of a conscious decision of like, what do you want to put out and how do you want it to be received? Because I feel like people do value again an album. I mean, a lot of that is about like value, you know.
Yeah. What is an album to you? Like, I think about like, sorry to bring Kanye West to this, but like Ye's Vultures, which is just this sprawling album that was released and then not released and then released and changed. And what is like, what is in your mind when you say people want an album again? What are you speaking about? A certain number of tracks that are all in the same world? How do you containerize that, considering we don't really need that container anymore?
I guess I think about it in terms of performance. You know, performance has a duration. A film has a duration. It might just be a kind of coping mechanism to deal with the passing of time. Everything is constantly unfolding and unraveling in real time. I think it's actually quite important to think about like markers, you know, like how can I navigate myself through the world?
An album versus a single, for instance, you need a certain duration in order to build the world in the listener's mind or like...
I mean, to get one example, I guess, maybe it's been a bit trite, but you know, it's like Pink Pantheress came up through TikTok and like she would just constantly re-edit her works for this like 2 minute marker or like 30 second. It was like very imprompted in terms of how that affected how the work was made and how the song would constantly be reworked.
Yeah.
And when I did a live album, it was like actually reworkings of the previous two Stephen Warwick albums and just deliberately not like remixing yourself, but allowing yourself to like think about improvisation across time.
I feel like anyone should know, we'll drop in some clips or whatever, but hearing, seeing, experiencing you live, it's a full body experience. You're very physical in your performance. And I feel like I want to like drop in the clip of Naughty, 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 which we play for Coco all the time.
That was a good example, you know.
Naughty, naughty, naughty. If you've been naughty, naughty, naughty.
I mean, it would be interesting also to hear you do a studio album now, but the improvisation vector feels like very core Stephen.
But I also think it's interesting. First of all, I constantly crave new albums, and I think of it as a way to kind of reclaim your time or get rid of the labor of navigating which songs to play and this kind of choice paralysis.
It's that's like true.
By this upfront forcing yourself to committing to a duration longer than 3 minutes, it's also freeing in a way. And I think that's
you know, a great point. I think that's tied
to why there's interest again in vinyl or cassette tapes, right? Where there's this disincentive to skip around and change the songs.
I mean, the
live album is, it's two 25 minute long tracks, right?
Right.
So you don't even have the option to like jump around. Right. And so I think, you know, so much of online media is all about the hook, like, can you grab them in the first 10 seconds
five,
to like hold them for another, you know, 20 more seconds to 3 more minutes? If you abandon that and instead of it doing all the work in that first few seconds, if you do the work in the first short period of time, then you're freed as a result and you can have kind of a different relationship with that music. I mean, of course, it's not like all of the market feels this way, but the people who do, I feel like that's definitely part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it relates to this function of switching off. And a good analogy could be like if you're DJing and you don't take requests versus like who's going to grab the aux cord at a party. And like everyone's like, oh, I got this on. And you're like, no, like, I just want to let something actually flow instead of it just being constantly disrupted. Also, like one of the functions of music is to just switch off or have something collective or communal, for want of better words, but just to allow something to unfold in time in a space. It's kind of funny when you think about this optimization of albums of like, ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. I was listening to a hip hop record today and like, there's all these like skits on it. And you're like, how would that track now? Yeah. Because like, it would be viewed in terms of metrics as unnecessary.
Right.
And it's also very like theatrical or choreographed. Actually, I really miss that aspect. It's just like a breather, you know, that's kind of its function. And in terms of when I was conceiving releasing a new album, like a live album, it was, you know, like I've played live a lot. And like when I play live, it's quite wildly improvisational. And it's very much about deviating from the original track or whatever. And I'd always conceived of like when I did Heatsick or something, it was me synthesizing or appropriating this idea of DJ remixing, but with like guitar pedals. And like also this idea of disco or something had all of these brass instruments and like real instruments or whatever. And then you'd have house, which sampled it. And then you'd have very expensive equipment in early dance culture, you know, samplers, synthesizers, they cost like thousands.
Totally.
And I wanted to kind of appropriate or copy that sound, but with the cheapest equipment possible. One, because it felt a bit strange, like carnivalesque kind of dare, like you're a plate spinner. But, like, but then also just this whole thing of like, can you pass? Can you get away with it? And you kind of could. Like, I remember when I played at Panorama Buff the first time in like 2010, and there's all these DJ heads I'm friends with. And they'd be like, wow, this drum machine sounds like a Lin drum. And I was like, well, guess what? It's like Casio, like, touchpad, which I'm doing with my hands. But I've always found that very liberating in terms of you can get the same effect. You don't have to have really flashy equipment.
Yeah.
And that you can just move a room. I mean, that's always what I found really great about music. It was very participatory and it was very immediate. And like, you know, when I'd been in art school, I just was like, God, everything's like a bit more stiff, you know?
Like, can we just get a quick Stephen Warwick history? Earlier, you just told me like the first album you ever bought was Madonna, Madonna's Vogue. But what's the quick trajectory? What's your self-mythology at this point? We all have one.
I guess I encountered rave and early house for school discos when you were like 8 or 9 years old. I still have very vivid memories of, you know, getting like Panda Pops or like these soft drinks and you just go mental and you just dance. And then like, I remember the next day you'd have the school assembly in the same room, but it's like the night after and the room was like really sticky and you had to like sit on it. But you kind of were like, it doesn't matter. And like, your like outfit was covered in gelatinous sugar. But it was like a great marker of like fun night, you know? And like, I just remember.
Wait, that's like a literal candy rave.
A literal candy rave. Yeah, yeah. But like, yeah, I remember when all those early dance songs became mainstream, they were everywhere. And I love like the Chicago stuff or whatever.
Yeah.
But like,
that was what was played at your school dance?
Yeah, you'd have some popular versions of Chicago stuff, like Big Fun or something.
Right.
Like
right.
That or Good Life. Like,
but that's, it's so funny compared to the States where like all school parties, there are people looking out for grinding.
Freak dancing.
Like on the news.
That's right.
A school says there is something wrong with a little bump and grind. Mount Lebanon is now enforcing a no grinding policy at its schools.
It's just going to be tough to dance, really, because it's pretty much the only way I know how to dance.
Everyone does it, and whoever goes to dance knows that there's going to be grinding there, so if they don't like it, they shouldn't go.
It's like it was all, every seventh grader was just like giving each other standing lap dances, basically, in the United States. The DMX or something.
But yeah, like, I mean, the other thing growing up was that, you know, you would just listen to Radio 1 and like you had insane access to really weird stuff.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I used to do my homework and then John Peel would be on and like, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you did like a lot of noise stuff. You had a lot of, you just did everything basically. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think growing up around that, you were like wow, like anything's possible kind of moment.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, you'd have like the breeze block. It just got more and more dancey. But I always remember being at school and I left the radio on and I fell asleep. I mean, bear in mind, this is like BBC radio.
Right.
Like, so yeah. It's kind of cool.
State radio.
But like basically they also had like proto Chris Morris stuff on, like Blue Jam.
Right.
And that was on before I knew who he was. And I just remember waking up in the middle of the night and there's this skit. And, you know, he's like, yeah, I've always felt like I'm a child stuck inside an adult's body. So I actually had a child's penis surgically attached to my body. And then they'd be like, actually, like, if you want, I could get in there. And like, you'd hear this zip. He's like, there's the fella. And like, I woke up to that. I mean, obviously that wouldn't fly now, but it was just more like, can you imagine you fell asleep and you're a bit like in between states, shall we say? And then you would hear a skit and you're like, did I dream that? Like, what the hell is that? But like, I distinctly remember that and being like, what the hell is this? Yeah. And then like discovering Chris Morris much later. And then later on, I was going to like noise gigs and this drone improvised kind of music, which informed a lot of how I perform. But even then, like, you know, you'd go to people's houses afterwards and they'd be playing like compact or basic channel. Mm-hmm. Like, it was just kind of like always there.
Mm-hmm.
Bearing in mind, you also had this like weird criminal justice bill around the time of the raves. So it was illegal to make music with beats so that you basically, they didn't want people dancing in fields.
Right.
Wait, it was illegal to make music with beats outside?
To like publicly broadcast it. Basically, like they wanted to crack down on raves. So they made this very bureaucratically, legalistically worded law. And then that's around the time that Orteca and people like that would be like, you know, fuck the criminal justice bill. Or like, you know, the inside of that Jilted Generation by the Prodigy would have that. Like,
Yeah.
It was very much referring to that. But it was just, it was almost,
what a beautiful problem to have, kids partying in fields.
Exactly. Like, anyway, you know, I always struggled with this idea of, did you have this? You probably didn't, like in England, you have like stars in their eyes. It was like a kind of celebrity impersonator. And it'd be like, tonight, Matthew, I'm going to be. And I just felt like that was a lot of, I studied this and I'm doing this and I'm going to perfectly remake it.
Uh-huh.
I just felt like very like mannered and a bit like ass licker or something. I mean, I had the same problem when I came to Germany and there was this whole like art school system of Meisterschule. And it was like,
right.
People would just basically be like, oh, I studied with this person.
Kreber.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And I was just like,
as though that's the past.
Yeah.
And because I was like, of it, you're.
Yeah. I was like, well, you're not that for association. It's like when like old money people talk and, yeah, and they'll be like, oh, well, I did that. Or my family
right.
did that.
Exactly like that.
But what
right.
did you do?
Right, right, right.
And then I was like, oh, is that your personality? Like who you studied with? Like that's your work? Mm-hmm. And I've always found that a bit baffling, to be mm-hmm. quite honest with you. I mean, you know, like in England as well, you had like the KLF or something. Like there was always a lot of like pranksters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And right. like people just, there's always just kind of quite disruptive or like a bit anarchic or.
Do you think in part that was because the music at that time in the 90s and early aughts was still governed by a commercial system that had a certain way of valuing music, a certain commodity object form of music, and so it felt like there could be an underground in relation to that. It felt like there could be a culture that really resisted that because that was there.
You could also live on the dole back then though, right?
That's true too.
You could easily live on the dole. You know, like Alexander McQueen was living on the dole when he was doing his collections. Like,
yeah.
It was very common to be on the dole.
And that was an identity in a way. I mean, some of you chose, some you didn't choose. But in part, it was because there was this normative path and there was an industry around music. And so resisting it was an active choice. And now we're in a situation where that way of valuing music has more or less dissolved.
Exactly,
so it's like you can't be a counter to it in the same way.
But it's also just possible because you could live on the dole. Like you didn't have to have a job.
Yeah, you didn't.
All of your money and free time didn't have to go to hustling to make money to not be evicted. I always think that's kind of the key.
But those are two things. Like one part of the identity of underground music or noise music or whatever was countering what was expected of you. And now, I mean, there is obviously a model. Like obviously there are acts that are very big that tour and have crazy ticket sales. But like just how has the formula changed now that that industry is less clear?
I mean, kind of goes without saying that like subculture died a long time ago and then it got appropriated semiotically. And we all know that kind of stuff. Yeah. What the question's really about is more like how our patterns have changed after the lockdown. this like more present reliance of screens. And I also don't want to go in that level either, because I always felt like social media was basically like glorified toilet graffiti. Mm. You know, it's not the problem. It's just part of human nature, which just loves to like expel. Anyway, I think it's like in terms of being hyper surveilled or hyper visible, you know, like we don't have Facebook events anymore. That's finally dead, you know? But like people would not want to necessarily share what they're doing. Just the value of having a party which might not be everywhere. Do you know what I mean? It's like this thing of Irving Goffman and the presentation of the self in everyday life. It's like a 50s sociology text where he was like, life's a performance, we're all actors, blah, blah, blah. Yes, we know that. But the idea of when you would recall a story, you'd kind of say one story to your parents, one story to your close friends, maybe another story to your partner or like acquaintances or what have you. And like he related to that in terms of being front of stage or like backstage. And, you know, you don't really have a backstage anymore. And it was just this desire to want to say a bad joke or just want to like this flattening of context. People want to create spaces again, which they feel they have agency over. And they want to just let something unravel without it being hyper curated, hyper, just to like let something be.
I forget what happened to Facebook events, because it was so huge for a while and there's no replacement really. Resident Advisor kind of, but that doesn't even allow DIY or, you know, semi-licit or illegal parties to be posted. Facebook events was like a wild west of
briefly,
in-person.
It was really useful. Yeah. It's like the only reason you use Facebook for a few years there.
Exactly. Yeah.
But it's I don't quite remember how
QAnon
just
must still use it.
Stop.
Like, there must be certain subsectors that still use it.
I mean, I know that, like, because for whatever reason, Witch House people started adding friends by the hundreds on Facebook. It was kind of easy to max out your 5,000 friends. But it's kind of like a loss of digital infrastructure that I think was actually important for a kind of IRL local subculture.
Yeah.
Well, because, it just became this, like, quite oppressive default mode of, like, you can't exist if you're not on it.
Right,
and then it kind of inevitably got replaced by something else, but then...
Well, it didn't get replaced. Everyone went to Instagram or Twitter or whatever.
That's what I mean. It didn't get replaced in the traditional sense, but it just dissolved.
Telegram or whatever.
Telegram. Well, that's a lot, Telegram group for parties. That's
right.
Yeah, there are weird WhatsApp or Telegram groups for like German psytrance raves in the woods or whatever. In them, but I know they exist. Although there's something, though, I keep thinking about. Maybe, I don't know if there's more to Stephen's lore he wants to share still, but I have been thinking about there being two different, there might even be three music infrastructures now, where there's like music, as we always kind of understood it to be, but then like music as content. Because it's like, even with the argument about AI music, I think the split between like music and content music is actually more
useful. Very good point,
like, actually. I was thinking, like, I heard this great remix of Demi Lovato's Cool for the Summer, which is like, it's one of my favorite songs probably. It was called like Cool for the Summer Hood Trap Mylan Core Remix Slowed. And it's like, okay, hood trap is indeed an internet genre, but like Mylan Core, I think, is the name the remixer gave to his own music. But it really sounds like nothing else I've ever heard. Some of his tracks have, these remixes have like tens of millions of streams on Spotify, but it can only exist as content. Like you cannot.
When you say
like
content, do you mean like for TikTok or you mean just, it's like.
Specifically to circulate. In the context of social media, the nature of the music, it's like you can't even imagine playing it at your house with other people there.
Totally.
Really. And so
that's really
I think though there is like right? And there's like funk and drift funk and all these weird like internet niche genres. Like, I don't think there's a scene attached to it at all. I think a lot of it is about actually like vibe casting.
I was
going to
say, is it like vibe conducting?
Like, yes. Right. Like, if you look at the social media accounts, there's one called like Lunona, I think. It's really like melancholic, kind of Crystal Castle-y electronic music. I kind of like how it sounds, but like they just called it Angelcore. And their Instagram is like all just vibe clips, right? And it's really, really like rich vibe curating. But you can tell that like the medium of that music is actually social media, right?
Uh-huh.
It's not about a social imaginary.
That's really interesting.
It's about a vibe world.
Yeah.
And it exists for an individual in their own thought space, right?
That
other people don't even exist in that imaginary.
It's like lo-fi beats to study to, but actually tuned to lots of different kinds of vibes that you'd never like listen to with other people. That's like a solitary thing.
I mean, you might listen to it with other people, but there's no imaginary but anyways, I wonder
that's an interesting distinction.
But I wonder if like music as music and music as content, if that is a split. And it kind of also makes sense when you look at the difference in streams, right? Like there'll be some Russian vibe electronic music, one of these producers I've been talking about, right? And they'll have like 500 million streams, a billion streams.
But no live shows.
But like, right.
You're talking, there's another artist you were talking about who said like the streams are fine, but they're not like,
you look at Boys Noize or something.
Well, exactly,
like, I don't
crazy.
Even know if any of the songs have cracked like 10 million, but like he's playing Coachella twice this year, right?
Right. It's
because those two things are functionally different. Like one is music as we've understood it.
Right.
And one is music as content or something.
Right. And music as we've understood it, then further can be broken into the kind that you would like mostly be like club music or festival music, or you'd listen in mass social context, and then a more personal kind of music that, you know, the sort of classic fracturing. But you're right. I think there's a macro category split where you have music as content versus music as music. I mean, how does that track?
But then also, I mean, I wanted to ask, you know, you have a desire to listen to that certain song in that music as content world. Like, what's the impetus behind that? Is it like a desire to escape in some way, or like just, you know what I mean? Like, I felt like there were like two different threads going on in that conversation. One of like, because, you know, it's always, you know, I love listening to like music you would hear in an Uber, and it'd be like a really weird, cheesy remix.
Totally. That's so specific.
Like the Slap House phenomenon, right?
But like, I got really obsessed with them. You know, I'd make like playlists of them, or like I'd DJ the odd song.
Or you like, just like Shazam it and then just like figure out what it was. And be some weird.
Or like, you know, you'd watch someone DJ and they'd be like quite consciously of like TikTok references of songs. But so there's like that thread. And then there's another one of like being drawn to something which is prompting you. And then there's another thing where like the music is content, where it's just kind of like, I'm just going to put this all out here and see what tracks. You know, it's like throwing a bunch of stuff in the wind and see what goes. But again, I feel like it goes down to like intention or choice of like, what am I being attracted to? And like, what's the conscious decision of like, is it because I'm choosing to be attracted to it, or I'm like, just kind of scrolling and this thing is like entering my mind and then I have a weird association with that. I always felt like that phenomenon of like scrolling and like those kind of like content music, it's more like this form of like meditation, you know, where it's like being on a screensaver where you just like, I just want to tune out. You know, is that what you've said on previous episodes when you're talking about like the content of TV shows, like True Detective or whatever, where it doesn't matter because, and I do it myself, like sometimes you put on like a familiar show you've seen, but that's kind of close to like when you're in a hotel room and you're abroad or you're traveling and you just want like a human voice on in the background. So you just turn the TV on and it doesn't even matter if it's in like another language you don't understand, because that's an ongoing thing of like a desire to have background noise. Just to kind of like, you know, like I always remember when Starbucks made this website, which was appropriating or at least pretending or maybe doing a live stream of like just people talking inside a coffee shop, and you could just play it on a website as like, you know, just to simulate that experience.
Wait, I feel like we have to find that.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's really incredible.
I mean, turning on the TV in the background, I mean, I do think there's like emergent, like refined over time, rhythmic and like tonal deep patterns in there that are like affectively charged in a way where like, you know, like having these things in the back, right? Because even you said it even works in a different language. It's actually more still about these rhythmic and tonal elements, I think, even when you
Like, I remember being a kid and being sick and getting to just like watch TV all day. And I remember, because you were like in this kind of fever dream delirium, like the way that the vibe of the TV around 1, 2, 3 o'clock when it was soap operas, it was always like ja, 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 ja. I can remember exactly what the tonal quality of that was, because it was soap operas and I didn't really care about them. I'd be asleep, you know.
And then, when the music starts, right? And exactly. Then there'll be a line that...
And then suddenly it would be like... Yes, cartoon time. I made it through the boring stretch of the afternoon. And then it was... like this certain kind of...
It's more delirious.
Yeah, and it was like the whole day, the TV had... It actually did conduct you through an entire day. And yeah, of course, this idea of like music as content, I think you're kind of talking about two different things though. I mean, Stephen, what you're talking about is this tuning out, this scrolling in the background, just this sound versus this thing that actually holds your attention very deliberately in a, like a Mr. Beast kind of way for like a period of time. And then you somehow feel compelled to forward it or interact with it or repost it, or it runs a script on you.
What does it evoke?
Yeah.
Like, does it evoke something in the world or a feeling like afloat? It doesn't signify anything. It's like
and
pure
quite consciously so as well. Like, it's not trying to be otherwise.
I was thinking about this in terms of constructing vibe. And it's like music is the like scaffold, right? Like that's kind of the backbone, which is a very different purpose or operation of music in this content music, which interestingly... Right, gets disproportionately very large numbers of streams. I mean, it's why I think like streaming numbers, even though it is like the metric that the industry uses, it's kind of tracking two different kinds of, like two fundamentally different kinds of music.
You send some notes beforehand. You say like, why has music been so utterly devalued yet is arguably the most important art form? The sense that a vibe is always built on top of music also, right? What does it mean to make next to nothing on streaming or sales, relying on performance where the margins are increasingly tight, with all creatives in general becoming downwardly mobile? You said the permanent underclass, Julian, is
the word of the year, right?
How do you...
I do want to add one provocation to that, is that, you know, I actually think if you're talking about the devaluation of music, music is highly valued when it's like content music.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Like if, you know, so, if there's a Kate Bush truck in Stranger Things... You can make money, or you can make money in film soundtracks. Or
you can make money if you're a 17-year-old kid from Russia who makes like a drift funk song that like is very viral, evocative.
I think I was thinking about that notion of music more in relation to how people still buy books and people want to go to performances, in like theatrical performances, or they still want to go to cinemas. And you're like, I was thinking about it more in that relation of like, what draws you to that? And I think it relates more to like the desire for like a social collective experience, which I feel that as humans is something we, I mean, we're social animals. So, I mean, I always think about when I did this residency in Spain once in Zaragoza. So, you know, if you wanted to get to the big city, you go to like Barcelona or Madrid. So you're basically talking like 1 or 2 hour train ride. And that was around this time when everyone was going on about audiobooks and like ebooks and like Kindle and stuff. But then also you just have all these people, like you live in the province, you just still read books, still do crosswords.
In terms of live shows, I mean, do you want to speak a little bit about the album, your Gush album, which is about to come out, and you're going to play a show at Berghain Cantina? Before before you release the album. You and Yvonne basically toured the album last fall, a mini tour, like in the UK. You know, then obviously the live at Cafe Auto. This comes from a show you played back in 2023.
Yeah, like, exactly. Yeah.
Just improvising tracks that you had already released, some that were new, just experimenting.
Yeah, like reworking, improvising them.
Walking into the new downtown in the upper atrium of the new downtown location is a zone of utter serenity.
I mean, look, you know, it just inevitably comes out of the fact that I used to play often and a lot.
Yeah.
And then the lockdown killed the idea of performance for a lot of stuff. So then it slowed down for me and I had to kind of like rebuild things.
Right,
and
everybody,
Exactly. That's what I mean. It was like a general shift. So when I played that gig, you know, I thought, well, I've got these tracks in progress, which, you know, I'm still writing this album. So I want to like show them. And some of them didn't even make the cut in the end. So they only exist on that.
Oh, cool.
On that performance and that cassette. But it was quite a deliberate thing to have the songs very stripped down. You know, like I always think about David Tibet once did this wired jukebox thing once and they played White House. And he was like, oh, I was always really drawn to how it's just a voice and a drum machine or like one synth line. And I was always very into that minimalism. Of it. I mean, you know, you could say the same about hip hop as well, but that always stuck in my mind. And my cassette, it's basically like a drum machine, a voice, and then my friend playing piano.
Cassette meaning this release, Live at Cafe Auto, comes out as cassette plus MP3 download.
Yeah, I
mean, but it's just side A, side B, right?
So, exactly. So it's also just like a massive 25-minute tracks.
Right. Yeah.
And I'd been thinking about, I mean, like in terms of releasing it, you know, like we'd been told like, oh, you know, everything's online, everything. And I was like, actually, it doesn't. Everything disappears, everything's deleted.
True, yeah.
So it's not like I'm fetishizing cassettes, so I'm that interested in the form per se. It's just I wanted to release something, you know, like what I used to do when I was like 25, when I just put out cassettes and CDRs. Like for me, it was just about dropping something very easy to do and just having it out there and be like, here you go. And it's not just this digital release, which is fine as well. But, you know, I just feel like that conversation has also changed. I feel like just people want to have an object again.
They do. I mean, we were talking about how Julian's parents were cleaning out their storage space and, you know, they were letting go of things they'd accumulated over decades, right? And we were thinking about our own small storage space downstairs. And we live in a relatively small apartment for our family. And we have very little storage space. And we're like, wow, most of what is in our storage are t-shirts and some extra books that don't fit upstairs. But it's like, that's really what we've held on to. And why? Because you might speak about it today as where the network layer touches down into physical space. And there are these small things like cassettes or a book a friend made or a t-shirt. And like how for our generation, that's this. I mean, I also say the t-shirts that we got from your dad are like amazing.
Yeah.
They must be good.
They're like some of the best objects that we could ever receive from your parents.
There was a Frontline Assembly shirt of his that I wore until it literally fell apart. Like it was just rags, tatters by the end of
it. I love it. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, culture. Just that's how it should be. I mean,
but it is crazy. Like I have some t-shirts that are 30 years old. You can wear 30-year-old t-shirts.
It's true. You can.
Yeah. I've got an obituary t-shirt and you can still wear it.
And I will say that the resale value, like I was looking at an old ICP.
That's the craziest thing.
It's insane. Yeah. Like shout out Sam Pulitzer, who founded at Beacon's Closet. He's like, hey, this looks like it will fit you. It was an ICP shirt that happened to be on a particular blank that like is really coveted. And it's a really nice ICP design. And it's like, I don't know, like $1,000 or something, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's crazy. It's like our generation is also valuing this as like the cultural relics of a culture that has mostly not been passed along materially.
I've been looking for a long sleeve Faith No More Angel Dust t-shirt for years. And one time it popped up in the UK, 150 pounds. And I didn't buy it because I happened to not have much money at that exact moment. And now it's only 500.
Yeah.
I mean, I always remember I had like a bin bag of band t-shirts. And I thought they were still at my mum's. And then like, hey,
got rid of that.
You threw them away. And I went, no. I was just like, hey, I'm just trying to explain to you, like that bag is probably worth 15 grand. You know, it's like insane.
Yeah.
Because there were so many t-shirts. Like, t-shirts being worth so much money for me is also a bit crazy.
But it's also like the space where it's screens like can't saying. Go. It's a kind yeah. of interpersonal display space. And it has like a lived experience. I mean,
dude,
there's a reason
screen
why.
Screen printing?
Whoa!
Whoa! Yeah.
But I mean, there's a reason why Palantir just did a merch drop. You know, there's a reason why OpenAI is doing like Mimi merch drops for their employees.
Triple tap a girl school. Gotta drop some swag.
God.
But that's so dark. What does it say when like, even like big tech firms right. like mass destruction are doing merch drops.
Right.
Like that's kind of wild.
It's really wild. What does that mean?
Yeah.
And they all have the kind of language of Virgil Abloh or of a streetwear drop right. and it's design
it's
language
innovation.
And it's
right.
packaging
yeah, yeah, yeah,
language,
yeah.
right? And yeah. it's like, I think the issue is that everyone's feeds and cultural consumption is so fragmented that only multinational tech platforms have the brand recognition.
That's interesting.
Yeah. To like yeah. actually make the streetwear mean something. Because
that's interesting.
Otherwise,
yeah.
it's like, totally niche.
Nobody's going to recognize it on the street.
No, there's really like, been this cul-de-sacification of right. culture. It's not like we have subcultures that are under, but we have like suburban sprawl of culture where you have all of these niches, but no one has enough visibility to actually make a merch drop right. like super impactful.
Right.
But not, like, not in the same way.
Yeah, not the same way.
I mean, also it's funny because you think about like, Mighty Supreme and the marketing behind that.
Yeah, A24's marketing has just been
but,
like...
But, you know, like, giving, like, Susan Boyle the Mighty Supreme collab, you know, as a film, it's really whatever.
Yeah.
And, like, it didn't win any awards and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But it didn't even matter because all that mattered was that drop.
I mean, it's like the... What I keep forgetting what it's called, the contract, the marriage...
The drama.
The drama.
Oh,
also,
this new film,
insane
yeah.
marketing push. Mm. Will I ever see that film? I don't know. Maybe. But does
I read
it matter?
The whole plot on Wikipedia if right. you don't want to be bothered.
It's not about
the
plot.
The mood is enough.
That's what I'm saying. It is the mood. And then these ancillary events that bestätigung it, register it in cultural consciousness.
Mm. Yeah, because also, like, if you watched it, you're not going to get much more than the prompt you've just read.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's not really going to unravel. It's very flattened.
Right.
Where it's just, if you like this, you'll have that. And then you're like, okay, cool.
Right.
I think the drama, though, is a cringe comedy or
that.
Drama or something. Just, like, people behaving badly in social situations. It was like my first encounter with it was probably Fleabag, which I was like,
I could not deal with it.
Like people saying they related to the character, but does that come out of like younger people's social anxiety of doing the wrong thing because they're online all the time? Or where does it, do you have any theories on it? I mean,
it could have a bit of it. I mean, like for me, Fleabag, I feel like it more comes out of that whole, like, British awkwardness anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, in terms of, like, younger people who are less socialized in, like, a traditional sense that we're used to, like, am I doing the right thing? Am I following the right prompt? It's like this weird self-metric of, like, am I doing what I'm supposed to do?
Right.
I mean, if we want to, like, link this back into, like, music again, it's just, like, seeing stuff live. I remember, like, the late 2010s where there was that whole discussion of, like, well, one, people just do playback, which is like fine because like, that's such a boring discussion about laptops or whatever.
When you say playback, just so we're clear. You
like
mean,
using a backing track.
Or just doing a sound piece.
Uh-huh.
And then you have this rise of the AV show because
right.
they had to compensate for that. There's like people want to look at something.
Yeah,
right.
Like if you go to a gig, people will watch someone performing. If you're in the club, people have this weird thing now where they want to look at a DJ.
But it used to not be the case.
Right.
I mean, it used to be the DJ would be like hidden, and the disco ball would be illuminating everyone.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
And the DJ was just sort of conducting the vibes from behind the scenes. Then suddenly, like, what was the turning point sometime around the aughts where suddenly the focus was on the DJ? Like, the spotlight
you have
turned.
Stuff like Boiler Room and stuff.
Yeah, Boiler Room, of course.
And like showing that you can do something live or like watching. But then, you mean that now we just have this. Like video podcast, that's become the default thing of like people are talking and they're filmed.
This is the neo-oral thing too, where I think people want to see news metabolized by another person. They want to watch the
because
facial
Because they
want
to see something material. And they can also see how that person is performing that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, then that, I could do that too. Well, judge it, but also like follow it.
Yeah.
But you probably have a stronger mirroring.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what I mean.
Like,
Emma Chamberlain is successful because, I mean, she's cute, she's funny, but she really channels something. People want to just see her live her daily life. They just want to see her reactions to like making a smoothie or putting on her shoes.
Out, right?
Right. Yeah. Mm. That too. Yeah.
I mean, I was thinking a lot about like influencers and how. It's the ultimate performance, you know, because...
Right, and those are just kind of like dead? I mean, isn't that sort of you don't think so?
No, it's just not novel.
Yeah, it's just not novel.
Dead. It's kind of become the weird default. Well, I mean, I watched that stupid Manosphere documentary with Louis Farouk, which is like whatever. But like, I was thinking more in terms of like, you know, if you have like O-1 visas being applied for now, it's all content creators. It's like not really artists. But then I was thinking like outside of questions about Manosphere and influencers per se, I was thinking more about, you know, they're not even performing themselves.
Yeah.
They're performing a weird version of themselves.
Right.
It's like, I'm going to tell you what you want to hear. And I don't actually really believe it myself.
It used to be the way, though, you would apply for a grant.
Right,
and then you'd have to, like, you know, hold your hands a certain way and say certain keywords.
Exactly.
And, like,
when you're doing, then you're being an influencer.
Right.
Because you're saying whatever they want to hear.
Like, I think we're seeing increasingly entities with money funding things that feel vibocratically on point, even though they're not on script.
Yeah. I mean, like, the grant proposal is very interesting because it makes a certain type of art and a certain type of artist.
Right.
You know,
which no longer matter, largely speaking.
And they kind of arguably never did because they're just hopping from, like, residency to residency, making the same essential slop.
Yeah. It is slop.
And it's just like whatever the government wants to hear.
That's right.
And that's boring.
Yes.
And that's a big, you know, like, you'll go to exhibitions and it'll just be the same old crap.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be like some nominal approach to AI, some nominal approach to equality, some nominal approach to whatever. You know, some of those things aren't bad in themselves, but it's essentially just like a glorified state-sponsored prompt in the flip side.
I love that, totally.
Yeah. But I think also there is a desire to be the contrarian or do something that could also mean, like, I deliberately want to listen to, like, AI slop or, like, shitty, like, taxi remixes because it's funny. And, I, you know, that's also how the world develops. But, like, it's also, like, a conscious decision, you know?
Right.
I mean, like, you can think about the same of, like, you know, consciously being, like, Muzak and, like, kind of thing. But, I mean, whatever, that's such a trite example.
No, true.
But, like, it's the same, like, fundamental impulse.
Definitely.
And, I mean... Maybe we should talk about...
We should talk about the albums a little bit, because also we're going to...
Maybe I'll talk about Gush a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, like, Gush does come out during the lockdown. It comes out of, like, improvising. I hadn't played live for 2 years or something.
Yeah.
And I was just in a room with my friend Ivan Brito, an Argentinian drummer, kind of studied at jazz school and a conservatory, blah, blah, blah. But basically, we just played for, like, 4 hours solid, just, like, playing. And then all of our songs came out of that single session.
Oh, wow. You recorded it for yourself?
We just recorded it for ourselves. And, like, when we did it, it was more just like, let's just play music. Like, because we were
at your studio in Berlin?
Yeah. Because you kind of have to, you know, like, you've not been allowed to perform.
Right.
You know, like, I was going crazy in the lockdown not being able to perform. So we were just playing for like 4 hours. And then all of our songs are like a few minutes long. And they kind of all come out of that. But they're kind of song form, but strangely improvised.
Were you also just like pre-associating lyrics at that time? Or like, was it more just sonic?
They started out instrumental. And then like, I would inevitably like edit them down. And then might make like very short lyrics. And they were quite witty or direct. But you know, like, it was more like, you do that afterwards.
Wait, can you just say a lyric?
I mean, one's called Naked in Netto.
I love that. My favorite.
Netto is like the discount grocery store here. Yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, I deliberately made all of the lyrics around Gush very much about playing around with mythology or imagination or like dreams or associations and like how I tried to remember something, but not in a nostalgic sense, but more like thinking about playing around with like popular folklore and stuff. And then, like, you know, in terms of the cassette thing, it's not about the cassette per se. It's just about, here's what I'm doing now. I've reworked all the songs. And people were kind of captivated for an hour, you know? I mean, I was also playing this like, very scuzzy guitar, which I hadn't done for a while. And I was thinking more about Royal Trucks or something. And they'd be like referencing free jazz. It's more about like, you'd watch band, they'd be like, why can't you do these psych out jams of your own songs? It's like, just playing around with it.
Although there is something I think that improv and the jam lends itself very well to digital platforms, actually. And I'm surprised it's not a model that we see more often because, I mean, you think of like tape trading of bands in the 80s or 90s. I mean, that's a very like internet before the internet type thing.
Dead, right? dead tapes. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, totally.
And
proto.
If you are able to improvise and craft albums out of it. I mean, yeah, I think
it also makes it more unique.
It does. Yeah. And then can make things rare. I mean, even now that things get digitized, they're still coveted files.
I mean, there's like, right?
It's kind of a, through abundance, there is a way that you can create a kind of scarcity again. So I think maybe this should be the first album of thousands.
Just keep. Now we're already recording the second one.
I wanted to get them really
going faster.
I also think, though, since so much of your music incorporates a spoken word or witty or strange poetry, I think with AI also, where you can take text and turn it into audio or an image and vice versa, language, again, and particularly like skillful mastery of it or use of it, it's like the super medium through which all others come out of, right? Like you have to prompt.
Well, I mean, it's funny. If you think in terms of like, and also I don't really like the word slop anymore. I think it's like obviously very lustrous.
Because there's so much slop that isn't AI. It's like,
but also the slop is actually well, it thinks it's well prompted. And it thinks it's like,
but also
clear.
Sometimes slop is actually like, I mean, this is a distinction Daniel Dessou made. Like sometimes the empty content of slop is even information rich, just not the kind of information that's human legible.
I don't mean it as like a value judgment. I mean, in terms of like slop actually tends to be like very well behaved.
Yeah, it is. Right. Yeah. It follows rules. I mean,
it has to, because it's like design. Yeah. I feel like that's the difference with it.
Well, we probably have to wrap up. Stephen Warwick, thank you for sharing your brain with us for this hour. And congrats on the albums.
Look out for the next 999 Gush albums.
Dropping them all at once. Manifesting it.
All right.
Thanks.
Ciao.
Cheers. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Models Talk Core, and thanks to Stephen Warwick for joining us in person to talk about his work and the state of music in a time of content. Stephen's album, Live at Cafe Auto, is available from Pan Records as a cassette plus MP3 download. And the debut album, Splash of Milk, with Yvonne Brito as Gush, is out now from Huntley's and Palmer's. Check the show notes for links. Back in Berlin, we're finally catching up post-Venice. We did a flood of recording with three more excellent conversations already in the can. A few announcements. Sunday, June 21st at Sybil, Berlin, we will be hosting a book launch with artist Trevor Paglen on the occasion of his new book, Seeing Like a Machine. And 2 days later, I'll be giving an artist talk with Spike Magazine, the evening of Tuesday, June 23rd at Soho House in Berlin. More info on all of it soon. That's all for now. See you next episode.
Hello? Hello? Okay. I must admit I'm feeling pretty good. Feeling myself, yes, I'm in a good mood. Don't go away alone, it's what I do. I get this feeling that I'm feeling blue. I'm feeling blue. It may be sunny, but I don't go out. People ask me what I'm all about. Tired and tired of this letting out. I cannot constantly hold faith and pout. I'm tired out.